We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Harriet Williamson is the producer for the show, and Kyle Mabry is at the controls this morning. This year, this program, Focus, turned 30, and we decided to mark the anniversary by bringing back some of the oldest interviews that we have in our tape library. Now, these are programs that are not part of our web archive. They have not been heard in many years. In selecting these shows, we've tried to highlight some of the most interesting people and topics that we have featured over the years. In this installment of what we have been calling our Deep Archives Project, we have two takes on beauty. One that argues that beauty is a largely social construction, the other that we are born with some idea of what or who is beautiful. Naomi Wolf is well known for her writing about contemporary feminism. She established her reputation with her first book, The Beauty Myth. That was a book that was published in 1990. And in the book, she argued that society had set a standard of physical attractiveness for women that was almost impossible to attain. At the same time, she said, women were being punished for not meeting that standard. In the book, she wrote that in spite of all that women had achieved, in terms of how they felt about themselves physically, they might be worse off than their unliberated grandmothers. Now, when I talked with Naomi Wolf in the summer of 1991, I asked her why.
It's because women did such an amazingly thorough job of dismantling the kinds of constraints that you were describing, the ones that trapped my mother's generation, what Betty Friedan called the feminine mystique of full-time domesticity, full-time obsessive, compulsive motherhood and housework. It's because that myth was so effectively dismantled, and feminism of the early 70s succeeded in creating the greatest social revolution, I think, in human history, that the backlash, which has taken the form of the beauty myth, has been so very, very strong. And so, in fact, the beauty myth has arisen in the modern form as a way to take over the work of social control that the feminine mystique can't manage anymore. Mm. And that's exactly why you refer to it as a wall that women are butting up against. It's more than that. It's a new ideology which is seeking to undo psychologically in women what the women's movement gave women politically and materially. And let me give you an example of that. As soon as we got, because of feminism, equal rights legislation that made it clear to employers that it was illegal because of Title VII to discriminate against women on the job on the basis of our sex, by gosh, employers began to sneak around that by discriminating against women on the job on the basis of our looks. And not only that, but this backlash is incredibly effectively institutionalized now. Courts upheld their right to do so, so that now you can legally lose your job if you're a woman for looking, quote, too pretty. This is something that happened to a policewoman out in Oakland named Nancy Faddle. Or you can lose your job for looking, quote, not pretty enough. And this has happened to Teresa Fichette, for example, the Continental ground personnel, who lost her job after 11 years of terrific service because she didn't wear makeup. And so now if women are being trapped more rigidly than ever before in these new ideals or a new ideology about beauty, it's not because they're, you know, too weak or too stupid to breach this last wall. It's because very powerful forces like the job market are conspiring to change the goalposts as soon as they leveled the playing field.
Mm-hmm. And courts have simply not responded to the arguments that women have made if that kind of discrimination is not illegal, it ought to be.
It ought to be. In fact, that idea that looks discrimination is a new guise for old-fashioned sex discrimination is a new idea, and we're just beginning to articulate it. I mean, that's what I had hoped to do in my chapter on work in the beauty myth. Mm-hmm. Right now, for instance, when a woman is sexually harassed on the job, as according to Red Book, 88% of women have been, her most immediate response is to blame herself and her, quote, poor control of her appearance. And what I'm hoping is that when women experience this kind of really obscene discrimination, they will stop blaming themselves and start to call this a civil rights issue and organize around it.
And, of course, what is the sort of disturbing and odd inconsistency is that not only, it appears, do we punish women for not being attractive enough, but, of course, we also punish them for being too attractive.
You know, you say inconsistency. It seems to me that that double-edged sword is... It proves, I mean, absolutely proves so beautifully that this beauty backlash is about politics and not about looks. Because, you know, what's a really effective tool to keep discrimination in the workplace? It's one where no matter how you look, if you're a woman, you can be made to feel that you don't look right, you don't look the part to get treated fairly and judged on the basis of your merits. I mean, women experience, you know, either being told, like this one woman who was a shop assistant, she was told by her boss, look, I have no problem with your work, but you need some help from the neck up. And as she said, this made her feel completely worthless as a worker. No matter how hard she tried, it wasn't her work that was being evaluated, but her appearance. The flip side of that is what happens, for instance, to Diane Sawyer, which is typical of how women are treated across the country. I was on Crossfire, and Michael Kinsley, who's supposed to be a liberal, said, you know, well, look at Diane Sawyer. She only got that job because of her looks. Now, that's a perfect example of the beauty myth undermining women's authority. The more that employers are tying women's looks into the job, the more easy it is for them to say, well, you only got this position, this tenure track, this chair, you know, because of your looks. The more thoroughly that undermines women's sense of self-esteem and their sense of being irreplaceable. And this isn't just... vague, you know, prejudice. This is a great way for employers to defend their economic interests. Because why is the beauty backlash taking this form right now? Well, what happens when you have a tremendous mass of women, newly empowered, who are asking to be treated fairly in a real meritocracy? Well, women work really hard, and if employers were forced to treat women fairly, half the jobs at the top that are now held by men would go to women. And so it's incredibly neat to develop this value system that says, for instance, in television, if you're a woman, your chance to be a journalist is tied to your looks, and therefore when you hit 40, no matter how good you are as a journalist, you become less irreplaceable, and this keeps the glass ceiling in place because it keeps men feeling like their seniority and authority grows with age, but women are made to feel that they lose what makes them employable as they age. So it's a very effective way of maintaining a double standard for payment for men and women on the job.
We're talking this morning with Naomi Wolf. She is the author of a recently published book, The Beauty Myth, How Images of Beauty Are Used Against Women. We have a couple of callers here to bring into the conversation, and everybody is welcome to participate. Someone here first on our toll-free line. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I have a couple of questions. One is, I'm a professional, and it seems like I spend a great deal of time worrying about weight. And I was wondering if you heard any pearls of wisdom in your research about how women deal with this effectively.
Oh, boy. I'm so glad you asked that question, because you've touched on the second biggest, hugest aspect of the beauty myth. One of the big things that's changed in the last 20 years, again, as a backlash against feminism, is that the ideal has shrunk. before the women's movement, the average fashion model Miss America weighed 8% less than the average woman, and today she weighs 23% less. Now, the point I make is that the ideal shrank not because there's anything more beautiful about thinness or even healthier. My research shows that, in fact, it's very unhealthy, extremely dangerous for women to lose that body weight that lets them fit that fashionable ideal. But the ideal shrank so that women like you and me would be, you know, more concerned about the size of our thighs than about marching on Congress, you know, so that we would be hungry, preoccupied, fatigued, spend that extra few hours of leisure time a week that we have after doing the first shift on the job and the second shift at home, so that we would have a third shift of compulsory maintenance of this chronically underweight state. So, I mean, what I would say, what's new about my book is to point out that we are all in a situation where most of us are consumed with anxiety about our weight, you know, not because that's good for our health, but because this backlash against feminism wants us to be consumed with anxiety about our weight. I think that that's a very liberating insight.
You have been talking about the beauty myth in terms of politics, but there is also undeniably money involved. Because you know, the cosmetic companies and the people who sell you diets and cosmetic surgeons and clothing manufacturers and people who run health clubs and all these kind of folks are interested in making money. Mm. And how, I mean, one might even look at it and say it's not as much politics as it is about making money.
Just capitalism?
How do you evaluate the relative contribution of those two elements?
I appreciate the question. So it's a really good question, and I would say that the difference in how these advertisers are allowed to sell to women and manipulate the media representations of women, the difference between the way they sell to women and the way advertisers for, say, cars and alcohol sell to men is where politics influences capitalism. Hmm. So you could say, sure, you know, it's a capitalist country and everyone is free to make a buck. Absolutely. What is scary and different about, say, the let's just take the cosmetics industry. These are a lot of things most women don't know. They don't know them because the kind of information women are allowed to get about the cosmetics industry's fraudulent claims for their anti-aging products is heavily censored by the cosmetics industry. So not only do are women's magazines and women's media supported by an industry that's selling women basically nothing, and not only do beauty editors have to supplement the lies in the ads in magazines that tell women that this stuff works, you know, the beauty editors have to lie to them too. And finally, the editorial content is largely dictated by the need to keep women enslaved to their looks and terrified about aging. And so most women don't know that, for example, because of the influence of these advertisers, most older women's faces in mainstream media are airbrushed out, so that a 60-year-old woman will look at her own face in the mirror and think, oh, my gosh, you know, I've got to get a facelift. I've got to buy $100 an ounce, you know, night cream, because I never see, you know, held up admiringly to me the image of an older woman's face in Time or Life or Newsweek or you know, Lear's even. And most women don't know that, for instance, an editor of a glossy women's magazine will want to run a story on a great woman architect, for instance. If she gets the pictures back and the architect is, quote, too fat, she has to spike the story. She can't run it, not because the architect is too fat aesthetically, but because her advertisers who are selling diet products would be very uncomfortable if women were given the message that it is okay to look any shape and size. Finally, things as ridiculous as the day after Claire all found out that another women's magazine was going to run a story on the glories of gray hair, they threatened to pull $60,000 worth of advertising. So what I'm trying to convey is men would be so much more susceptible to the blandishments of the beauty myth, for example, if they lived in a media environment in which Time magazine couldn't run pictures of Gorbachev because Minoxidil was a major advertiser. So basically men get to see unattractive old guys running the world, right, whereas women only get to see a tiny, tiny narrow slice of fashion models and women who resemble fashion models because of this censoring influence.
We're talking this morning with Naomi Wolf. She is the author of a book entitled The Beauty Myth, How Images of Beauty Are Used Against Women. It is published by William Morrow and Company and has just recently come out. We will try and accommodate all the callers we have in the time that we have remaining, and we'll go back to the phones here. Line number three is next.
I think you would agree, perhaps, that the spirit of our times is one in which is very pro-youth, anti-age, sort of pro-health. Then I'm not sure why you want to appropriate this sort of discrimination and say that it's only against women, because in my experience, I know men who have felt that because they lost their jobs, they had to lose 20 or 30 pounds so they could look youthful and employable again. Mm-hmm. The examples you give of saying there are no older or fat women in women's magazines, you shouldn't compare that to Time. You should compare that to GQ or a men's magazine. Where,
well, I'm happy to. Even there you have profiles of men from Norman Mailer to Henry Kissinger, sad old guys.
But yes, but these are men who are powerful. And I think that
there are plenty of powerful older women. Ann Richards couldn't be on the cover of Vanity Fair.
Excuse me, if I could just make my small point, and that is that what often is the negative point for men, or the, I don't know how to say, anti-selling point, is that men who are either poor or powerless are ones who tend to be discriminated against, versus what you might say women are discriminated against for their looks. You may disagree with this, and that's fine, I understand, we can discuss this. But in Time magazine, you will see powerful women, you will see Thatchers, you will see women who are congressmen or senators covered. I don't think that's the venue that you would really need to make the comparison. It's not between women's magazine and Time, but women's magazines and men's fashion magazines.
See, okay, here again, I think that we need to take a look at what culture is. Because of the influence of the beauty advertisers, perforce, women's culture is beauty culture. You know, women's magazines are beauty magazines. So you don't have the full range of magazines of various interests for women that you have for men. I mean, men's culture reigns all the way from Sports Illustrated to Popular Mechanics. And I include Time magazine because if you do a statistical breakdown of what, say, mainstream, ostensibly mainstream culture is focusing on, 80% of the people on front pages in newspapers across the country are men. Time magazine rarely has a woman's story or a woman's issue. It's still, mainstream culture is still too often male culture. And so I was being a little bit deliberately provocative in using that example. But
could I make just a couple of points and allow you to respond, because there seem to be a lot of people on the line, so I thought maybe do this promptly. First, just on the level of logic, your position seems unassailable, because you keep on talking about a nebulous conspiracy of men who are trying to put down women on the basis of their looks. And so there's no way I can logically disagree with you, because you can't point to anyone who's doing it.
Uh-huh.
And so it sort of weakens the argument, because all you're saying is that all us bad men are once again discriminating against women.
You haven't read the book, have you?
I'm only basing upon what you said. This is true. And the second point is that what strikes me is you keep on saying, you see, this seems a bit odd to me, that women are powerless. You keep on saying that women don't read any of these other magazines, and that to me seems to be a disservice to women if you say that, no, there aren't any women who read Popular Mechanics, there aren't any women who read these other magazines because they're men's magazines. You keep on saying that people who disagree with you, like Barbara Walters, well, they must have a hidden agenda, or that...
Okay,
I'd like to... It's rather paradoxical, but I'll listen, I'm sorry.
Okay. Okay, let me take your points one by one. First of all, yes, we're in a youth-worshipping culture, but where women where the numbers are different, for instance, 95% of bulimics and anorexics are women, 87% of people who get cosmetic surgery are women, 95% of tenured faculty are men, where the numbers imbalance, that's where politics is happening, where men's incomes peak a full decade ahead of those of women, that's the glass ceiling, that's politics. So yes, you know, the fetish of youth culture, which is tied into capitalism and, you know, the American belief system generally, affects both men and women. The difference is that women, you know, where women suffer twice as hard, that's what my book is about. You raised some other issues. I didn't say women didn't read mainstream culture. I said that there are women's culture is very important, and that unfortunately most women's culture, women's magazines, are supported by the beauty industries. And that, you know, when I mentioned men's culture, it's not that women don't read it. It's that they're geared primarily toward men, men's interests, and men's concerns. What's your third point? That there's a vague conspiracy. I don't ever suggest that there is a vague conspiracy at all. I say quite clearly in the book, this is not a conspiracy theory. It doesn't have to be. If you were to read the beauty myth, you would find that I don't by any means blame men in general at all. In fact, I argue that this is not about, you know, what individual men are doing to women at all, that most men are supportive and loving of the women they live with, and you know, say, you know, I'm not doing this to her. I don't want her to starve herself. I love her the way she is. But that what women are up against is male-dominated institutions like the workplace using ideas about beauty to keep a woman down on the job. And I am very, very specific about that. I target about 15 different cases, for example, where, as part of the collective unconscious, judges ruled that this kind of discrimination was acceptable and legitimate. Now, conspiracy, you know, it didn't take a smoke-filled room for the men at the Century Club here in New York to say, you know, let's keep out blacks and women and that way keep all the lucrative business contracts for ourselves. They didn't have to sit around in a smoke-filled room. The nature of having power is that you don't have to plan it. You just do it. And it looks natural and comfortable because you're supporting the status quo. Nonetheless, the New York Supreme Court said, you know, that is conspiratorial, that's illegal. So what my book is really about is the collective unconscious, and I cite very specific examples of the collective unconscious at work, like when Christine Kraft, you know, lost her job because she was, quote, too old and too ugly. And then I talk about, you know, these four industries that are very consciously conspiring to censor images of women and to lower women's self-esteem.
That is Naomi Wolf. She was a guest on this program. Back then we called it Focus 580. And this was in July of 1991. We were talking about her first book, The Beauty Myth, the book that was published in 1990. At the time, the ideas that she laid out were controversial. They remain so. I leave it to you to judge just how much things have changed for women in the last 20 years. In the years since we talked, that is Naomi Wolf and I, she's continued to write about American politics and also gender relations, and she's also worked as a political consultant. She was involved in Bill Clinton's reelection campaign in 1996 and also in Al Gore's presidential run in 2000. This is Focus. It's our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. This year, this program turned 30. And in celebration of that fact, we've been digging into our tape archives, bringing back some of the interesting people that we have talked with in the years past. You can, by the way, tell us what you think about this or any other Focus program. The easiest way to do that is to go to our website, which is WILL.illinois.edu. And if you go to the Focus section, you will see a place there near the top of the page where you can leave a comment. And certainly we'd be very, very happy to have any thoughts that you have on the program, what we have been doing over the years, this particular series, going back into the dim and distant past of Focus, or anything that we're doing now. Again, just go to the website. It's WILL.illinois.edu. We'll have another program from our deep archives coming up in just a couple of moments. First, we will take a short break. This is Focus.
John Waters describes himself as a cult filmmaker whose core audience consists of minorities who can't even fit in with their own minorities. He's best known for his films Pink Flamingos and Hairspray. On the next Fresh Air, Waters talks about his book Role Models, the stories of people who've inspired him, from Johnny Mathis to Tennessee Williams. Join us.
This afternoon at 1 and this evening at 7 on AM 580.
Thank you.
This is Focus. It's our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. This year, the show, Focus, when we started, we called it Focus 580, but it's the same show, and this year the program turned 30. And we thought it would be interesting to observe the anniversary, celebrate, by going into the tape archive that we have that contains some of the oldest interviews that we have. And these are programs that are not part of our web archive. They're shows that have not been heard in a very long time. And what we tried to do was to go looking for topics that were interesting and guests, some of the most interesting people that we've talked with over the years. So in part two of today's show, we'll continue the theme of beauty. And we have a very different view, certainly different from the ideas that you heard in the first part. While Naomi Wolf approaches beauty as something that is defined by popular culture and enforced by people who want to sell us something, psychologist Nancy Etkoff says that while commercial culture might well try to exploit our feelings about beauty, it did not create them. She is an assistant clinical professor at the Harvard Medical School. She is author of the book, The Survival of the Prettiest, The Science of Beauty. And when we talked back in August of 2000, I asked her how she became interested in beauty.
Well, I've been studying how we recognize human faces, what's distinctive about the human face, human facial expressions, and I came across some of the literature on human beauty. And what surprised me about it was how different it was from the common wisdom. The common wisdom is that beauty is in the eye of the beholder, that either our perceptions of beauty are idiosyncratic, each of us has a different idea, a personal idea, or that beauty is something that we're taught and by the culture, that we're fed images by the media, we're told these are beautiful people and beautiful fashions, whatever, and that we learn about beauty. Hmm. What the research suggested was something quite different. It suggested that even three-month-old babies will stare longer at faces that adults have rated as attractive, and that perhaps we're born with a desire for beauty, with an interest in beauty, and with beauty's power to rivet our attention. I also looked at some of the cross-cultural data that was coming in, and that was quite interesting, too, because we would predict, you know, on the cultural model that people in different lands would look very differently at what was beautiful. In fact, what happens is that people agree far more than they disagree about who is beautiful, so that even when researchers have gone into remote tribes in Paraguay or Venezuela, they find at least rough agreement with what people in this culture would say. So it was quite an interesting picture that was developing, and it was one I wanted to delve into because it was so much against the common wisdom today.
Hmm. Well, I'm interested. Maybe we could talk a little bit more about this idea, the work that has been done on babies and what we see when they look at faces.
Yeah.
They seem to be programmed to, and it's not surprising, to really look carefully at faces and, in fact, to read facial expressions, and again, not surprising, just because their survival depends on their ability to bond with the adults that are supposed to be taking care of them.
Absolutely. They're completely dependent on their caretakers, and babies are riveted by human faces practically right from birth. They'll prefer to look at faces or face-like objects more than anything else in the world. And what's interesting is that when babies as young now as 1 month have been tested, they also seem to pay particular attention to attractive faces. And this is somewhat disconcerting. We don't like to think that they're neonate beauty judges or anything, that even they notice looks. But somehow, this has been done now in three or four different labs. What they do is they sift through a set of faces, and it's men, women, people of different races, even other babies. And they'll have people rate them for attractiveness. And what they find is that the infants seem to pay particular attention to the attractive faces. They will look longer at those faces than they will at others, where they lose interest more quickly. Now, of course, this has nothing to do with their own interest in their caretakers and the people they know. Of course, those faces are very important to them. They bond with their caretakers. But when they're looking at faces of strangers, of people they've never seen before, they're particularly intrigued by the attractive faces.
Hmm. It's something that's also interesting that goes the other way is that, and again, you would have to guess this does indeed have something to do with
with the need to propagate the species and the fact that also you want people to bond with their children or at least look kindly upon children. That is, we seem to be programmed to be drawn to the physical characteristics that babies have, particularly the fact that they have kind of big heads and little bodies and big eyes and tiny little noses, and that we're programmed to that, and that again, you can see that, and it explains why it is not only are we drawn to babies, but we're drawn to kittens and to cartoon characters that have those same characteristics. We have this set of programming that when we see that, we go, oh, isn't that sweet, and it's just something that's there, and again, probably one of those things that if it wasn't there, the species might not have hung around too long.
Absolutely. It has huge survival value, and yes, we're irresistibly drawn to juvenile features, and so that big head and the big eyes and the little button nose is something that seems to just release in us, you know, this emotion of it's sweet, it's attractive, and we want to take care of this person or even this cartoon character. People want to cuddle toys that look like this. And it's interesting, Stephen Jay Gould, the biologist, wrote a great little article about Mickey Mouse where he showed that over time how his face morphed from kind of more rodent-like features to this very juvenile proportion, and it coincided with the exploding popularity of these cartoon characters. It's a very clever marketing device because it exploits what is a natural preference for and desire to cuddle and hold anything that possesses these juvenile features.
Does that does that influence the way that we as adults look at other adults and what we think of is what we think of as beautiful and attractive in a grown-up human being?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, certainly for children, the more children fit the kind of prototype of the juvenile, the infantile features, the cuter they seem to us, particularly little girls who have these features. In adults, often youthful characteristics are considered quite attractive, particularly on females, but not so much infantile characteristics. I mean, there's kind of a mix of that big-eyed innocence, but then with more mature features as well. But all through life, the kind of baby face look is one that's very hard to escape. So if someone has baby-like features, they'll be seen as adults as more trusting and as more naive. And this can work to their advantage or disadvantage, clearly. A baby-faced leader may have trouble leading the troops, but a baby-faced descendant may look more innocent. You know, it's amazing how much, and this is one of the aspects of beauty that I cover in the book, how much we judge a book by its cover, how many inferences we make about a person just based on appearance, and how hard sometimes we have to work to overcome the stereotypes that people bring to us based on our appearance.
And I guess here we'll get down here to the central issue of mate selection and what that has to do with what we think about beauty and how this maybe is a pretty old idea, that again, it seems to be the case that no matter what we say about what we, it's the inner person, it's their spirit, it's their soul that we value. The fact of the matter is, when it comes to picking a partner, at least initially, looks really do matter.
Yes, there's all kinds of evidence that people really do focus on appearance, at least initially, when they're looking for mates and romantic and sexual partners. The biological idea behind this is that basically we're looking at biological advertisements for health, for fertility, for youth. We're basically looking, unconsciously, of course, at someone whose genes may combine well with ours. And this is not what we're thinking about when we think about a mate. We're thinking of someone that we can talk to, someone who's a good soul, and all the rest. But somehow, there's also an automatic part of ourselves, that automatic beauty detector, that is also looking at these other biological characteristics as well. And beauty is, in part, a signal, as a kind of visual language that signals health and fertility.
It does seem to be the case also, and this seems to follow what conventional wisdom says, that looks do matter more to men than to women.
Yes. In every culture where the question's been asked, men tend to say that they value their partner's appearance more than women say this. So again, a lot of this is based on self-report, but in general, men do say that, and women are much, much less likely to focus on a man's appearance alone. They're more likely to also think about men's character and less lofty men's resources and money and power. And again, there's a biological rationale. A woman, unlike a man, shows a steep decline in fertility with age. By the age of 35, fertility has gone down, and it goes down even more steeply after that. So youth and appearance, in part, are markers of fertility, much less so that, you know, for men. Women also bear children. They need help when bearing children. And so that a man's resources, his steadfastness, his ability to stay with the mother and child and to make sure that they survive are very important characteristics in a mate choice. And so you're seeing basically different strategies of the two sexes in trying to figure out how they and their genes will survive. Interestingly, some of the newest work on women suggests that there may be kind of two different female strategies, and one which is more like the male strategy seems to emerge, and it's quite interesting. Women, when they are fertile, when they are in the ovulatory phase of their cycle, you'll see much more female promiscuity then. You'll see much more focus on male appearance, even changes in judgment of which are the most attractive men, defining the more traditionally handsome men, particularly attractive during this time of the month. So in a way, there may be two different female strategies, and one more matches the male when the female is the height of her fertility.
Perhaps at this point I should just real quick introduce again our guest for anyone who might have tuned in. We're talking with Nancy Etcoff. She's a faculty member at the Harvard Med School. She's also a practicing psychologist and neuropsychologist at Massachusetts General Hospital. Has done research on the perception of human faces and has produced a book that looks at a wide variety of research that addresses this question, what is it we find beautiful and why? The title of her book is Survival of the Prettiest, The Science of Beauty. That's the subtitle. It's available now in a paperback version. It's published by Anchor Books, came out this summer, has some interesting things there, so you might seek it out. And, of course, questions are welcome. 333-WILL and toll-free, 800-222-WILL.
Another caller here in Sigel. It's line number four. Hello.
Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
I guess when you talk about gorgeous people, we assume that they're nice. I am just the opposite. I assume that they're shallow, that they have been deferred to since infancy, and that if I find out they're really, really nice, I almost feel, darn, how could they have all these things going for them? And I have heard other women say things like, and you know what? She's even nice. You know? So I just have the totally opposite. And I would even go so far as to say that that it's the exceptional gorgeous person of either sex that is really down to earth and nice. So I'd like to hear you comment on that. Am I the only one that looks at it that way? Thank you.
Not at all. And that's what I was saying before. The stereotype is much more of being competent and popular and successful. Matter of fact, there's kind of a dark side to the beauty stereotype, and I think this is what you're addressing here, and a lot of people feel this way, particularly about beautiful women, but also about beautiful men. This stereotype is that they may be shallow, conceited, vain. Some people believe when they look at a very beautiful woman that she won't be a good mother, in part because she'll be much too self-absorbed. So there is this kind of dark side of the stereotype as well. And there's, of course, yet another negative stereotype that sometimes gets attached, which is the kind of dumb blonde joke, the basis of the dumb blonde jokes, that sometimes when we see very beautiful people, we assume that they're not very bright. Now, why people make sometimes these negative assumptions is an interesting question. I think one issue you bring up is we assume that people have catered to beautiful people, and that tends to be true. There is an advantage to beauty. People tend to agree with them more, seek them out, do favors for them. There have been social psychology experiments where people will, it'll be rigged up. People will be standing next to a car with a flat tire. You know, the better-looking person is more likely to be helped first and all that. And so, yes, that's in part where the stereotype comes from. We have to realize, and another basis is that we like to believe in a just world. We like to believe that someone is extraordinary on one dimension, perhaps they're lacking in another. It seems to be a more fair way to look at the distribution of human characteristics. But truth be told, I think that there's that they're orthogonal, that beauty and kindness and intelligence can all come together in one person or not. And but we do hold these stereotypes. Hmm.
One of the things that you write about is some of the research that's been done where you would take a collection of photographs of people's faces, and you can make it very diverse. You can have men and women. You can have people from different ethnic backgrounds, and with a variety of facial characteristics. And yeah. Then you can go around the world, and you can start showing people all of these pictures, and simply ask them, "Tell me who among these people is you think is more attractive? You know, rate them according to their attractiveness." And apparently, there is a surprising amount of agreement across cultures about what qualities of a face, and it can be, you know, it can be someone who is of your group. It can be even somebody who is different. It apparently that doesn't really matter, but there are some things, some qualities of features where you get this kind of universal agreement that says this is an attractive person. What is it in the face that people seem to respond to?
Yes, an interesting question, interesting point. There is a fair amount of agreement around the world and across very different kinds of facial features. So this suggests that there's a kind of abstract geometry of beauty, a psychophysics of beauty, if you will. It's not a particular feature. It's more the geometry of the features. What people tend to find attractive are, well, in a female face, when we exaggerate female features, when we make a female face as different as possible from a male face, people tend to find those exaggerations very attractive. So when people are younger, their faces are more similar babies, you know, boy and girl babies, we have a hard time figuring out which is which. Mm-hmm. And then after puberty, the faces diverge much more. Male faces show more development. They develop a larger jawline and more pronounced brow ridge. Some features, such as the nose, get larger. Female faces are much more like child's faces. They have a smooth brow. Their eyes look proportionally larger, nose smaller. Their jawline is much more delicate, much smaller. Therefore, their lips look larger. And when we exaggerate all of these characteristic feminine features, people will tend to see the face. First of all, it'll look quite young because youth and femininity are just correlated in the features. And it will look more beautiful to the average person. And so in a way, as kind of the face is a peacock's tail, an exaggeration of what is prototypically feminine in the face. The male face, interestingly, this exaggeration of sex-typical characteristics is not necessarily seen as the most attractive. So if we make a man look hyper-masculine, make his brow ridge even more pronounced, his jaw really big, some people will see this as attractive, particularly other men sometimes will say that's a handsome man, but women tend to see this face as too cold, too dominating, a little Neanderthal, if you will. And so the average male, or even sometimes a slightly feminized male face, think of Leonardo DiCaprio or some of the younger male movie stars, those are often found attractive to women.
Hmm. I think it's, as I was thinking about this, I guess I found myself thinking that if you look at particularly when it comes to the women that I guess would be considered beautiful enough to be movie stars and yeah. to be professional models and so forth. If you start looking very carefully at their faces, it yeah. becomes obvious real quickly that there are sometimes really odd things about them, that they're certainly not, they don't look like Barbie dolls. They're yes. they're not perfect. No. And that there may be little things where you think, where you start thinking, well, God, you know, when in fact, some of the characteristics somehow in isolation from one another, you might think, well,
that it's not,
yeah.
You know, there's something about the, oh, her nose is too big or her lips are too big or her, you know, there's something sort of crooked or, you know, odd sort of little things when you start being real hypercritical. And
yes.
Yet there are people who, these are the women that you see on the movie screen and on the covers of Vogue and things like that. And it's just, it all sort of started me wondering, well, what is it exactly that we are responding to in the way that this collection of features comes together?
Yes, exactly. Well, the old ideas about beauty, you know, dating back to the Greeks and the Renaissance ideals, were mathematical formulas, and they believed that everything should be in harmonious, everything should be in proportion. So sort of what you were saying here, that things should all fit together very well, and they were particularly interested in symmetry, and they didn't mean symmetry the way we do today, where the two sides are equal. They meant that it's proportionate, so that, let's say, the hand, the finger should be three thumb lengths, and then the arm should be five, and whatever, you know, so that the whole body was, every part was in proportion to every other part. We find over time that that's simply not true. That's kind of an idealized image of beauty, and that our ideas of beauty are going to turn out to be mathematically probably much messier, and that they will be more of this kind of flamboyance, showing off of particular features, exaggerating them even beyond what we find in nature. We do love exaggerated features. I mean, that's in part what we do with makeup. It's what people are going crazy with in plastic surgery, this kind of hypertrophied examples of human features. And in the animal world, the same thing. The longer the tail, the brighter the spots or whatever. Animals will have more mating success. So we seem to like the supernormal stimulus. The other thought I had in listening to what you were saying is it's extremely interesting, no matter how beautiful a person is, no matter how gorgeous the model, the actor, the whatever, we can always envision them being even more beautiful. They seem somehow imperfect, and we get very picky about appearance. I think this is one of the really intriguing things. We all have an ideal of beauty in our mind. But somehow that's where it stays. We have an ideal that's not quite embodied, and that is this idea of perfect, some kind of template in our mind. And yet each of us, you know, as humans, each of us, as Durer said, could be even more beautiful. And I think that's in part what drives this endless quest for beauty that everyone has, no matter how gorgeous. Even the most beautiful models will say, gee, I wish I could change this or that. And it certainly keeps the big industry rolling.
And that is Nancy Etkoff. She was a guest on the program back then that day. We were calling it Focus 580, but it's the show. She was a guest on the show in August of 2000. The book that we were talking about, Survival of the Prettiest, is still in print. As a matter of fact, now it's even available as an e-book. She is an assistant clinical professor at Harvard Medical School. She is also a psychologist at Harvard Med School and the Massachusetts General Hospital. This year, this program, Focus, turned 30, and one of the things we thought we might do to celebrate is to go back and to bring back some of the oldest interviews that we have, shows that we have not had on the air since they were first broadcast. And what we try to do is go looking for interesting topics and people, and you can tell us what you think about these programs. In fact, anything that we do on Focus, you can tell us what you think. Probably the easiest thing to do is just to go to our website, which is WILL.illinois.edu. If you go to the Focus section and you look near the top of the page, you will find a place that you can leave a comment. And we'd certainly like to have any comments you have on the programs that we air.